Sure. Let's start. Yeah. So for those of you who are hungover or didn't set your clocks, this is not the A-B testing. Welcome to the future. This is the Make It So panel. So right. Time to adjust.
Exactly. I'm Nathan Shedroff. I'm the program chair of a new design MBA program out in California at the California College of the Arts. You think I would know the name of my institution. And I've been in the interface world since, I don't know, the late 80s or something? Longer than I care to admit.
And I'm Chris Nossel. I'm a senior consultant with Cooper in San Francisco.
So we've been watching a lot of science fiction lately, and I assume maybe that's what it's one of the things we have in common with you. And what we're going to present is some of the things that we found that are interesting about interfaces that we see in the science fiction films and TV, for instance, that we think has relevance and has lessons to teach us as interaction designers. This is what we're going to be showing is probably less than 10% of what we've seen so far. We probably aren't even a third of the way through our whole list. So there's actually a lot more coming. We're hoping to do a book by the end of the year, so you can watch this space and maybe own a piece of it yourself. And if you don't want to take extensive notes on right now, we're posting all the notes online. In fact, a slightly older version without all the new material is already posted at nathan.com/thoughts. It'll be on the upper right side called Make It So, but we'll get it up in the next day or two with the notes from this updated presentation.
Yep.
So the whole question that we're asking here is, how does design influence science fiction? And then how does science fiction influence design? We've chosen to focus on just the interface. So we're really looking at lessons that interaction designers can learn. So we're not looking at technologies. We're not looking at engineering. We're not going to start trying to discuss how plausible the transporter is from Star Trek, et cetera. We're really just looking at interfaces to behavior and systems and see, we're not covering the transporter and already people are leaving. I'm sorry.
I actually think they were here for the A-B thing. It's 11:30, guys.
We're also, although there's a lot of stylistic things we're finding about the visual portion of the interface, we're not expressly looking at styling in the interface either. We're really looking at interaction function and behavior. We've chosen to focus on science fiction from television and films, and to some extent from industry films. So if you ever saw Starfire from Sun or the, you know, ubiquitous, legendary now Knowledge Navigator, we're looking at things like that as well. So film and TV, we're not looking at books, we're not looking at manga or anime, partly because the interface has to be realized and presented to a certain level for us to even take a look at it. It has to be consistent from frame to frame and page to page. We're not looking at books, interfaces described in books, because there's not enough of a visual depiction for us to make any sort of reasonable commentary or learn from them. We haven't started looking at games yet, but that's also a possibility. One of the problems with games is that it's hard to distinguish the game interface from the interfaces in the game. So for now, we're pretty much just looking, and the examples that we have are science fiction film, TV, and industrial films.
And Nathan's talked about science fiction, Nathan's talked about design, and the other sort of thing we have to cop to before we get into the meat of the stuff is, what do we mean by influence? And unfortunately, it's really hard to scientifically pinpoint something that influences another thing. So honestly, it's just conjecture on our part, but it's well-founded conjecture. And hopefully our examples will illustrate and back us up on this. So what we're going to do today is we're going to take you through sort of the big model. Oh, that's really dark. Awesome. Hey, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And actually, I can sort of turn and watch as well. So the first thing we're going to take a look at is how design affects science fiction. And the way it does that is by establishing the paradigms that science fiction builds on. And then we're going to take a look separately at the ways that science fiction influences design. And that's one of four ways. Either by giving direct inspiration to someone, by setting consumer expectations, by reminding us of the human side of things, which we're calling the social context, or by reminding us of the computer side of things and what we're calling the proposed paradigm. So without further ado, let's sort of dive into the paradigms. What I'm going to do is sort of to establish this fact that, yes, design influences science fiction. We're going to take a little time travel here back to the very beginning of film. So when we're going to take a look at this, it's really useful to remind ourselves about the technology paradigms that were in the audience's heads when they first went into film. So one of those was the telegraph from 1867. Of course, people were really familiar with the telephone. Graham Bell or Elisha Gray had invented it about 1876, depending on which side of the lawsuit you believe. And even though the Lumiere brothers in 1895 had had their first audience into a piece of film, and radio didn't come out until a year later. By the time we get to 1902 in the first sort of science fiction film, people were very familiar with the radio as an interface, or rather, I'm sorry, as a technology. So the thing, this is our first sort of science fiction clip to show. And the thing to notice in this clip is actually that there are no interfaces. So how do they shut the door? They actually just pull
it shut.
The
cannon is loaded.
How do they get to the moon?
The bridge is closed.
They fire out of a giant gun.
Everyone is anxiously waiting for the signal, which starts the shell on its voyage.
Yes, those are the astronauts inside the barrel.
The officer gives the signal. The gun is fired. And the shell sees the eye.
And then they go to the moon.
The shell comes down with a crash.
So on the one hand, this is sort of charming to us. But on the other, it really pinpoints that the audience at the time had no concept of interface because they lived in an industrial era metaphor, right? It wasn't till 25 years later, after World War I, that we get into the first sort of serious science fiction where we see an interface. And that's in Fritz Lang's masterpiece, Metropolis. So take a look at this clip. And this is an engineer from the upper city, the elite class, who's making a video phone call to a worker in the, and a wonderful, overactor, in the lower class of the metropolis. And take a look at the, metaphors that are in play here as he uses this video phone. So he comes and he checks his messages essentially by ticker tape. No, nothing of interest there. So he turns on his video phone and we see a film metaphor come up. What's really delightful here is that now to find the channel he wants, he tunes it like a radio. In fact, you can see sort of that fading in and out between the different video channels. And once he's got the channel he wants, he picks up a phone and dials, and then this marvelous actor answers the other line. Why don't we have acting like that today? So let's contrast this little piece of interface, which is a mishmash of all these paradigms from sort of the 18th century, not 19th century, 1800s, with a film that comes 12 years later. In this clip from the 1939 film Buck Rogers, we're seeing somebody use a similar device. It's a video device. But pay attention to the way that the general actually changes channels. Rather than dialing like a radio, he's doing something entirely different.
Wilmer and Rogers must prevail on the Saturnians to lend them a spaceship to return to Earth.
That's no Saturnian craft, Doctor. It's one of Killer Kane's spaceships.
Impossible.
I know that type of ship too well to be mistaken.
He actually
tried to contact him on our wavelength.
As a matter of fact, I haven't.
We must do so at once.
And he has a single button simply to turn it off. It's not sort of a mismatch of controls. And of course,
there's a spaceship to 274.6
doors. And they go into a separate room. Actually, this is a little bit charming, actually, to hear the audio for the same video, which is strikingly charming. But what happened in between? Why did we have to tune in our first interface? And in the second, let me just turn a dial. Well, what happened was the advent of television and electronic television, because mechanical television had occurred years before. But suddenly, the audience had access to the concept that, yes, our technology can be controlled by a discrete dial rather than the sort of indiscrete and fluid radio controls. Now, it's really easy for us here in the enlightened 2008 to say, well, that's charming and we're much more tech savvy today. But in fact, as little as 6 years ago, filmmakers were still having to take, is it six? No, goodness. Who can do the math? 93, 2008. 15 years ago. Spielberg is actually taking a lot of pains to explain to you what it is that is happening in this marvelous scene from Jurassic Park as the little girl saves the day.
It's a Unix system. I know this. It's all the files of the whole park. It tells you everything. I gotta find the right file.
So dinosaur, as the dinosaur screams, I'll narrate a little bit. She's having to tell the audience, oh, there are files, there are folders. It tells you what you want. We see this unbelievably slow animation, you know, to get her to what she wants. And even in a moment, you'll see that the camera actually locks onto her hand to show you why, yes, she's moving a mouse to make all these things happen on the screen. She's right after this claw. There we go. Ah. So the audience is able to go, oh, I understand. And it's sort of understandable. In 1993, we're still getting used to the desktop metaphor in the general public. But hopefully that serves as a reminder that, you know, we're still subject to this force today. Science fiction can only really build upon the paradigms, that are out there in the world. And as designers, we sort of end up, you know, when our software products and services go out there in the world, we establish that paradigm. So hopefully that first part has sort of convinced you that, yes, there is a degree of influence from design to science fiction. And now we're going to go down from science fiction to design. And while the sort of this larger structure talks about sort of, you know, this is what we consider to be true, the other part is what we consider to be useful. And these are the lessons that we can sort of pull from these things. So I'm going to start with the first bar and talking about inspiration. And this piece of inspiration is really about an individual getting inspired by something that they've seen in science fiction. And there's not a lot we can do about it as designers, but it is a category of influence, and there's a wonderful story we get to tell about it. In the year 2000, a fellow by the name of Douglas Caldwell was successfully petitioned by his son to go see a crazy movie about mutant superheroes, fighting other mutant superheroes. And he didn't really want to go, but he wanted to bond with his son. So he went, and to his surprise, during the course of the movie, he saw a solution to a 2,000-year-old problem.
Magneto is here, Liberty Island. Now, presumably, his objective is to mutate the world leaders at the UN summit on Ellis Island.
He doesn't know his machine kills. And judging from what the professor saw, if Magneto gave Rogue enough power, he could wipe out everyone in New York City.
So,
all right, well, we can insert here at the George Washington Bridge.
I'll go ahead and pause them, actually, because this is a marvelous frame to pause on, because that's impossible in a pin board. You can see that the bridge is actually floating there. and you only know that if you pause in this particular frame. Now, the reason that what Doug saw here was that he actually worked for the U.S. Army Topographical Engineers. His job is essentially to equip generals in the field with 3D maps so that they can plan strategies for military, you know, conquest. And what he typically has to do, or before this movie, they would actually have to sort of predict where a battle might take place, get the topographical data, make the map, ship the map to the general in the field. And all of this was kind of error prone, terribly expensive. And worst of all, if the battle ended up taking place on the mountain instead of the valley, you were kind of screwed. And what he saw here was a very sort of imaginative presentation of that same data, but sort of on demand. So I think it was in 2001, he took this idea directly from X-Men, put out an RFP, and within 5 years was working with a company called Xenotran to produce the Xenovision. Here's a look at the inside of that machine. It is a computer-controlled array of pins, but he actually did it one step further. You can see this box top actually clamps down. It gets a vacuum seal, and that little piece of tan you see, that tan square you see, is a thin sheet of rubber, on top of which he can project satellite images. Then you can turn on the vacuum, set the pins, and suddenly you actually do get a real-time, on-demand topographical map of anywhere in the world. So here you can see the sort of vacuum sucking that rubber down, and suddenly we have valleys to play with and move our little tank toys around. And they've also used this to like map Mars and take a look at the tsunami from the Philippines. It's actually a marvelous piece of technology, and it is directly derived from... we interviewed Doug, and he says, no, he's copped to it. This is directly from X-Men. And we talked to as many people from the X-Men movies we can. We can't quite get at Brian Singer, but the art director has told us that, yes, it was Brian's idea, and it actually came from the store, those little pin things that you get in the store where you can put your hand or your face in and hold it. Okay. So that was a fantastic little illustration of inspiration. I'll hand it over to you.
And that actually illustrates one of our first lessons here that we found is that science fiction is a powerful cultural influence, and it's a medium where designers' ideas about what are possible and what to expect are actually influenced in a way that influences what comes out on the market when we buy things later. Next, we'll talk about expectations, which is another one of the powerful influences that science fiction has on the design world, especially the interaction design world. And this is that expectations of technology are set in science fiction in the public, in their minds, and what they expect to either do or how to use things in the future is forever changed after this. Yesterday in the Kill Your Mouse session, someone had made reference to the Jeff Hahn multi-touch technology and Minority Report, and these two get conflated together a lot nowadays. And this is a really good example of how science fiction is setting expectations in users' minds and in the minds of the public for what kinds of technologies are appropriate, what we're going to see.
In fact, the panelists actually called it the Minority Report thing.
Exactly.
You know, when they did this.
So this is also the reason why many of us are still waiting for our jetpacks after 50 some odd years, right? Because we were told we'd have them by now, and they're not around. So the first thing we're going to take a look at are robots. And robots were, you know, sort of coined back in 1922, but this is one of the early movies that robots really started to come into their own. We saw them in Metropolis, but they didn't start to be a regular sci-fi thing until 1951 with The Earth Stood Still, or The Day the Earth Stood Still. And here we have Gort coming out to help his master, who's been assaulted by the less than tolerant Earthlings. And so robots are a science fiction staple, of course, and they've influenced the spending of millions, if not billions of dollars on human-like machines that effectively create an ethics-free slave class. And that set our expectation about, you know, what we should expect about robots and their especially menial jobs.
Good morning, sir. Yet another on-time delivery from...
Get the hell out of my face, Kenner.
So, of course, the more they start emulating humans and take over human jobs, apparently they're taking over human behavior, and they're just as annoying as humans can be as well. And this is all despite the fact that robots really don't have any clear industrial use for these human sort of representations. The robots that we see in factories, for instance, are, you know, big sort of industrial arms, or we see things. There's one launching very soon to the International Space Station. They don't look anything like the robots we see in science fiction. We do, however, see in industry people spending, again, millions of dollars to create these kinds of human-like robots, because we've already set the expectation that this is what we should A, be working on, and this is what we should be expecting. And even after the millions of dollars, we still have this problem of, what are they going to do? They're going to serve us coffee. You're like, isn't there a better way to get coffee to people than... So by setting these expectations, it doesn't mean that they're good expectations or they're good uses of money or, you know, resources, etc. Here we have another example where the form from science of a technology in science fiction has been directly translated into what we use today, or certainly what we saw back then.
No sign of Dr. McCoy. Search progressing.
So this is an episode of Star Trek, of course, from 1966. Remember that date. This is a little bit later in the same scene.
Captain, I've lost contact with the ship. I was talking to them. Suddenly it went dead. No static, just nothing.
Kirk to Enterprise. Scotty.
He has to go to IT.
Sort of
the communicator.
Can you hear me now? Yeah. A moment.
And IT,
Captain,
couldn't help him.
I've lost contact.
Apparently, they're on T-Mobile as well. So what happens here is that we grew up on this, and engineers and scientists and designers and the public at large has grown up with these kinds of things in our cultural heritage. So we come to expect these things. And it's not a coincidence that exactly 30 years later, we can juxtapose the communicator with the Motorola StarTAC. Right? Has the same form factor. It was a revolutionary form factor in its day, right? And it is essentially the communicator. Now, we can't draw a direct link here from the communicator to the StarTAC simply because we can't find the engineers who worked on it to verify it. But certainly there is a cultural expectation at work here that when people saw the StarTAC, they immediately knew how to use it, how to work it. They were comfortable with it. It wasn't some freaky, weird, you know, this kind of thing that they had to get used to. And that's one of the primary ways that science fiction is influencing the design world. So lesson number two is that your audience may already be predisposed to certain kinds of solutions or pre-comfortable with certain kinds of solutions that can help you aid your design process and your decisions about what's an appropriate use of your, you know, choice of your design explorations. Next, we're going to talk about the human side. And this is, the social context is basically reminders of the limitations and constraints of who we are as people and how we relate to each other and especially how we relate to technology. And one of the things that we're going to concentrate on, we've actually found a lot in the social context you can only imagine, right? Half the sessions here at South by Southwest have something to do with social or social networking. It's a really rich area. So we're just going to talk about one aspect of it today, and that is anthropomorphism. And for those of you who don't know what anthropomorphism means, it means making things human-like, but specifically sort of in the representation. So Asimo, the Honda robot you saw earlier, is an anthropomorphized robot. And it's not just robots that can anthropomorphize. We'll see in a second. Everything gets anthropomorphized. So the first obvious examples of this, of course, are Microsoft Bob in 1995, followed by Clippy, who had a 10-year reign from 97 to 2007, just killed off last year. And these aren't just early experiments with, you know, funky, cool ideas of anthropomorphism. They have a long history, and it's a continuing history. So on the right there is Ms. Dewey. Has anyone been to MsDewey.com?
Okay, so in memoriam, she's dead now.
She's dead now, yeah. The site is still up, but she isn't. This is probably a good thing. If you've been to Ms. Dewey, all she is a video interface to what is just a standard search engine. And so this is an experiment in anthropomorphizing the search engine to see if it has any effect or what kinds of effect it might have on people's acceptance of the search results, et cetera. It was kind of pointless because it was really just sort of applique to a search engine. And not only pointless, it was she's really annoying.
Yeah,
and in actuality, she's kind of a bitch.
Yeah.
She sits there and she's like, you know, she's, this isn't kind of the behavior that we want out of our systems. We don't want them to embody sort of the most annoying characteristics of humans, although it does make them seem more human. But, you know, maybe we should focus on the things, the pluses and the positives that we want out of human behavior. But this is a really good example. These examples here about the experimentation that's happening here. And this is all based on, especially Clippy and Bob, are based on a lot of really great, significant research. If you're interested in Nass and Reeves' research, you should read the book, The Media Equation, because this stuff is all real. We have reactions to technology in human social ways, but how you implement them is really tricky. So here we have another example that's actually predating all these. This is 1987. This is Knowledge Navigator from Apple.
You have three messages. Your graduate research team in Guatemala, just checking in. Robert Jordan, a second semester junior, requesting a second extension on his term paper. And your mother reminding you about your father's
surprise birthday party next Sunday.
Today you have a faculty...
So this is a really good example of where this anthropomorphized effect is actually being really successful. He's not annoying, he's interruptible, he's constrained to a certain set of expectations of behavior. He doesn't sort of flow out into unexpected behaviors. And it became a real important example of what technology might be in the future that was acceptable and, you know, we could all see it. So one of the lessons here is that clearly social aspects of the interface are appropriate and appropriate to explore and implement. Anthropomorphism can aid learning. It can speed use sometimes. And it can make people more comfortable with interfaces. And that's not just visual adornment. That's something that's really valuable and deep. But the other lesson here is that wading into this area is really tricky to do right. And so you shouldn't do it lightly. And you shouldn't just approach it as applique or pastiche. Another thing to point out about anthropomorphization is that the visual references, the visual representation of humanness isn't even important to make the effect work. Sometimes sound is just enough to still give that anthropomorphized effect. Some of you may remember Knight Rider. For those of you that don't, I think it's actually out on DVD. And now we have the sequel series, which apparently isn't very good.
Yeah.
But in Knight Rider, the talking
the request,
car.
But I will need a little time. These are not simple calculations and evaluations.
So he's a little curt and maybe annoying at times. But for the most part, Kit's a really helpful piece of technology that's become a character in the series because of his voice. And his voice is specifically given a fairly human rendering. That's it. That's all that carries Kit's personality, quote unquote, or his anthropomorphism. He has the little scanning eye from the, you know, Battlestar Galactica, the original Cylons. But that's it. These two representations carry the anthropomorphizing effect. Another example of this, which we're all probably familiar with. Hopefully you can hear it. So R2-D2 is probably one of the most endearing characters in the entire Star Wars super, you know, double trilogy, whatever. And he doesn't have a human representation. Certainly his form isn't physically representing humans. All he has are a couple odd sound effects. He doesn't even speak, which is kind of weird because C-3PO can speak. So why can't R2-D2, right? So the entire emotional content and our connection to this character is carried by his voice, in this case, his sound effects alone, and very effectively. I'm not kidding when I say that most people connect with or like R2-D2 certainly better than C-3PO and over many of the other characters in the series. And a last example of this from Star Trek.
Commander Riker. Picard to Commander Riker. Answer, please. Computer, locate Commander Riker.
Commander Riker is in his quarters.
So here again, the computer, the main computer in the Enterprise, we only get the only part of the anthropomorphism that is rendered here is the sound, and it's a very human, high fidelity human voice. And what that does to us as audience is that it imparts assumptions about the capabilities of the computer being somehow more sophisticated or more interesting or more capable than if it were just a series of sound effects or if it was a very robot-y voice or something like this. So these are specific choices made by the production designers of these shows and these movies that impart messages to us about what our expectations are about these systems. But sound isn't even always necessary. We found that you can start to suggest and get some of the same effects by simple behaviors. A good example of this is OneClick in Amazon. So OneClick essentially, aside from being just super easy to click, OneClick is essentially a behavior relationship that's set up that says, it's not unlike maybe your favorite bartender in a bar or if you have a hair cutter you always go to. By clicking OneClick, it says, hey, welcome back. I know who you are. I trust you. You trust me. Let me get your usual, I'll handle all the details because we have that kind of relationship. All of that is at work when you just hit one click and it's done for you. So by behavior, it's starting to suggest a fairly sophisticated social arrangement between you and what is essentially a system. And that's a very human relationship. Yet there's no, you know, sort of one click bot or character there. There's no human representation. There's not even voice.
Or a Clippy,
thank goodness, right? So sound is enough to trigger anthropomorphism. Sometimes behavior is enough to do it. And let's talk now about the representation here. Now, in science fiction, we don't always get human representations in anthropomorphism. Sometimes we get things like animals, in this case, animism, or we have aliens, etc. If anyone remembers Until the End of the World, the search interface, it's funny that these things, a lot of these things are around, revolve around search, was called Bounty Bear. And we can't get a clip of this yet because it's not on DVD, but Bounty Bear would lumber across the screen, I'm searching. And he's really kind of cute, but it gives the audience a sense that there's something more going on here than just a couple lines of code. This is more powerful, more sophisticated, something else. And of course, in The Matrix, there's no code until some very special shots at the end. all code is represented as humans.
The Matrix is a system, Neo. That system is our enemy. When you're inside, you look around, what do you see? Businessmen, teachers, lawyers, carpenters. The very minds of the people we are trying to save. But until we do, these people are still a part of that system, and that makes them our enemy. You have to understand, most of these people are not ready to be unplugged. And many of them are so inert, so hopelessly dependent on the system, that they will fight to protect it. Were you listening to me, Neo? Or were you looking at the woman in the red dress?
I was...
Look again.
Okay, so here there is no representation of code. All code is represented as other characters, as human characters, and that imparts to the audience a sense of depth and sophistication, in this case, danger. I was a little slow on the draw here to freeze it on Agent Smith. Agent Smith is a search and destroy program. He's just code, and yet he's represented as a human, and to the audience, that imparts more danger, more sophistication. It's a bigger problem when it's a person that's up against you and hunting you rather than a couple lines of code. In this clip, when Neo talks to the Oracle.
I know you're Neo. Be right with you.
You're the Oracle?
Bingo. Not quite what you were expecting, right? Almost done. Smell good, don't they?
Yeah.
I'd ask you to sit down, but you're not going to anyway. And don't worry about the vase.
What vase?
That vase.
So... the Oracle also is just a bunch of code, but she seems more accurate and more interesting, even more powerful as a representation of a person, because it invokes in us all the other things that trigger when we deal with another person. And so this kind of representation changes our expectations about what to expect of these systems, because they're just systems, but also what to expect from the movies, the films and TV themselves. Oh, so the lesson here is that the more human the representation, the higher the expectations on the part of the audience or the user. And this is where you can get in trouble with anthropomorphism, because if the expectations are raised beyond the capabilities of the system, you're screwed, because then you're, you know, it's 1995 again, and Microsoft Bob pretty much not only doesn't sell, but just elicits ire from all your users.
So if anthropomorphism is a great way to sort of talk about the social context, you know, that we are humans, we're going to be using these systems, we have certain constraints and requirements. The proposed paradigm is where we come in and actually do an evaluation. This is where our designer hats get to put them on and say, okay, does this system work or not? And then possibly, you know, use those lessons in our own work. So we have four examples. The first example from a given proposed paradigm is an example of something that sort of we all know as designers, and seeing that in film really acts as like a touchstone. Oh, yes, that reminds me of this particular principle. The one example is that constraints ease learning curves. We all sort of know this, if you're given like a command line interface like DOS, you have to remember a whole lot of stuff. It's really hard to learn. It may be powerful, but not so much for beginners. Whereas like a WIMP interface has a lot more constraints and affordances to it that really help you use it. And we see examples of this in science fiction all the time. So this is a pro example. In the movie The Fifth Element from 1997, we see a group of our protagonists trying to kickstart a weapon that hasn't been used for 1,000 years. And pay attention to how Bruce Willis' character actually figures it out.
You got it figured out, Father?
This one should be fine.
You don't know how all this works?
Theoretically, yes.
Theoretically?
Now that the four stones should go around, the fifth element should be in the middle, and then the weapon against evil should work.
You've never seen this work before, have you?
No.
The weapon has a man in it. Sure, this has one too. That's it.
Match up the symbols. Go, go!
So without any manual, it's actually these affordances. Oh, I have a triangular spot with a certain pattern on it, and I have a triangular stone, so I can figure out how this works. An anti-example of the same pattern comes from a short that preceded. Yeah, I love this one too. Preceded Ratatouille from last year. And in this, we sort of meet a little alien who's sort of learning the ropes. So the whole joke here in this little interface humor is that there are no affordances. There are no constraints to this interface that he has to learn. We all recognize that. And it helps to remind us again as a sort of a touchstone of things we already know. A second category is of sort of propagating things that are known in the lab, such as inputs should know the affective states, the emotional states of their users. An anti-example from film of this, again, comes from The Fifth Element, 1987. This is the antagonist, well, one of the antagonists, Zorg, who is choking on a cherry pit, and in his panic tries to mash on his desk interface, or actually tries to use his desk interface, but ends up mashing it.
Where's the robot to pat you on the back? For the engineer.
So I'm going to pause that one. But, you know, the system should know, hey, mashing is not a common behavior, so I should summon security, not start throwing shirts around. But, of course, the system doesn't know this. So it serves as an anti-example of that principle. Oops.
Coming to my party.
Hold on 2 seconds. I'm going to go back and restart the video. In the second pro example from 2001, Dr. Floyd is having a video conversation with his daughter back on Earth. He's up in a satellite orbiting. Pay attention to her hands as they have a little video conversation.
I'm sorry, sweetheart, but I can't.
Why not?
Well, you know, Daddy's traveling. Very sorry about it, but I just can't. I'm going to send you a very nice present, though.
What?
Anything special that you want?
Yes.
What?
A telephone.
So right there, we can see the little girl begins mashing on the keypad next to the telephone, but we don't hear any audio. The phone call isn't interrupted in any way. And while this might just be, you know, Kubrick sort of overlooking this detail, let's credit him. And presume that the system is actually smart enough to know that, hey, I've got a little 5-year-old girl, 4-year-old girl here, and I need to disregard this input. So those are two examples of sort of, again, us using our designer hats to evaluate systems and try and derive some lessons for the real world. And the last two examples from this track are sort of things that work in film that we can then say, well, okay, if it works in film, there must be something there that we can use as designers. For instance, scale and social hierarchy. Star Wars is littered with holography. And one thing to note as you watch the films or rewatch the films is that the different factions use different presentation mechanisms. The Jedis, who are all about democracy and evenness, even though they actually end up being a bunch of liars, are that they all are presented in the same size in their holographic representation. There they are. We're all sitting around in chairs. We're all the same size, and therefore we're sort of all equal. Even when you're projected out and sort of mixing this real world with holography, they make some effort to make them all look this, you know, the same size. Contrast that with the evil Empire, who are deeply vested in their hierarchy. And when Darth Vader sort of kneels down to speak to the Emperor, he doesn't see an Emperor that his same height. In fact, what he ends up seeing is a giant floating head.
What is thy bidding, my master?
There is a great...
So this actually works in the film. The audience sort of knows, oh, I can see this interface and I get it. These guys are hierarchical. These guys are sort of more democratic, egalitarian. And so that's something that we can actually use in our design by looking at the way that it worked in film. How do we use that in our own work? If you're designing like a video interface and you've got a boss, somebody who's identified as the leader, then maybe they end up being bigger. And I'm just going off the cuff for that one.
But any social interface, whether it's iChat or IM or texting or video chat or video conferencing, etc., this is an opportunity to use this understanding this lesson about social hierarchy to either play with or reinforce whatever the natural social hierarchy of that situation is.
Yep. And so the last example we actually have for our talk is a sort of an anti-example of things that end up not working in film. And this one is about gestural interfaces. And of course, when I speak about gestural interfaces, I'm speaking about Minority Report, which if you haven't seen the film, it was the biggest science fiction blockbuster since 2000. And sort of the thing that really got burned into people's heads was a video scrubber that the primary protagonist used to look through what amounted to video to look for clues to crimes that were about to be committed. And in order to control the system, he, you know, had these beautiful little LEDs on his fingers, and then all these gestures ended up moving the video around so that he could scrub through them and find the clues that will prevent the murder.
Under license registration. See if I can capture the address. Running out of time.
Play hockey still. Okay. And we've spoken with John Undercoughlin. He did have sort of a whole plan underneath this. But what they sort of found out during the course of the filming was something that didn't work. And that is when you're using a gestural system and every single motion you make has meaning, well, how do you do something with your body that doesn't engage the computer? And in this case, our protagonist is being introduced to an investigator.
I got close. Thank you. Danny Woodward, tween from the Fed.
And we ended up shaking his hand.
Sorry, Danny, I'm going to have to give you the full tour some other time.
The marks has moved.
He certainly didn't intend to wipe his desktop clean and restart, but sort of the little interface joke here reminds us that, you know what, that's a problem we're going to have to solve. And Undercoughlin's sort of copping to it at this moment in Minority Report. So again, that's another example of when we put on our designer hats, get to evaluate the systems that we see inside of science fiction and then use lessons from that in our own work.
Yeah, there's actually a hidden lesson in that one, too, and that is that most people don't know, and until you talk to the filmmakers, that Tom Cruise got really tired of doing this. This is not an easy thing to keep up all the time. So with all the expectations now raised about gestural interfaces and won't this be really cool, there's an underlying problem that has yet to be solved, which is this is tiring after a while, and if you're trying to write a book or do your work on a spreadsheet, maybe that's a problem that needs to be solved before we start instituting these kinds of behaviors into our systems, even though the expectations are already there, because very often the thrill of seeing it on the big screen and the expectations get raised about it are sort of undercut by actually having to do the thing when it's sort of instantiated in real life.
Either that or we could distribute steroids with the interfaces.
It's a caffeine lover's dream. So again, the lessons here are that what works for audiences often works for users. And we can look at science fiction in a sort of academic sense and learn from it, both the mistakes and the successes, and put that into our design process. There's another lesson, and that is watching science fiction is good for your career. So to conclude and to open up our questions and answers, this is only the beginning. Like I said, we're about a third of the way through our list. I'm sure your favorite movies and TVs, you know, not all of them are up here yet. This is about 10% of what we've looked at so far. So there is a lot coming. But if you have favorites, let us know and we'll, you know, put them on our list because that would be pretty wonderful. We don't want to build something that feels fairly complete and then misses something really important that we just didn't happen to get to. Look for a book, hopefully by the end of the year, hopefully, that has this material in it. There'll be a section that is sort of encyclopedic, which catalogs what we found in everything, but then there'll be a section that is really the lessons and the discussions of these topics like anthropomorphism and affective states, et cetera. And you can email us with your questions and ideas, et cetera, after this. So,
can we get the lights up?
Please. And are there questions?
Thank you.
I think they want you to go to the...
Yeah, so the people at home know what you're asking.
Exactly.
What are your opinions on the theory of the uncanny valley on anthropomorphism?
Uncanny valley.
For those who don't know, the uncanny valley is a study that was done out of Japan where they studied that the more human-like your representations are, that the sort of more empathy we have towards those characters until you get just close enough to human that people begin to evaluate them as if they were another human. And the things that are wrong begin to make you think that that person is sick or an unfit person to be around. Okay. So do you want to take that as the end of the conversation? oh, it's right.
Yeah. Well, and it's proven out by what we've seen. So again, to reference the media equation by Clip Nass and Byron Reeves, there's a lot of really interesting discussion about subsets of how this anthropomorphism works, things like seduction and trust and I'm trying to think of one of the, it was a really good influence, and how it's played out. So flattery, for instance, and they've shown in the lab that, you know, something like one computer flattering itself, users start to sort of, you know, get weirded out and think less of that computer. And it's crazy, right? And these aren't just sort of people off the street. These are Stanford engineering students. They're actually fairly smart students, fairly smart people. But they also found that one computer flattering another computer, anyone know what's that? See where this is going? What happens? You start thinking higher of both computers, right? And so this is, why is this? We know they're both computers. We know they're fixed programs. But any sufficiently sophisticated experience or interface just triggers all our socialization. It's just really easy to fall into treating a sophisticated object like we do other people. And so the whole thing about the uncanny valley is really true because it bears out our experience with other people. The more a person exhibits personness, the more comfortable we are. But as soon as they start falling outside that personness, especially sort of on the backside where they're sort of untrustworthy and inconsistent.
Sick.
Yeah, you don't want to be around them, which is one of the reasons why consistent branding in corporate experiences is really important. Because, you know, if you use the device and then call customer service and then walk into retail and then see a commercial and it's not the same person, it doesn't seem like the same character or brand, you start to think, you know, there's something sort of schizophrenic here or multiple personality. I don't trust this company, brand, device, place.
And one last thing about this framework, the reason that we had to split up sort of lessons from the social context and lessons from a proposed paradigm is exactly that reason, is because humans aren't going to evolve to technology anytime soon. So we have to remember that, you know, we're pretty much a fixed part of this equation.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Hi there. My name is George DeMatta, and I actually run the internet's longest running 2001 fan website. It's been up since 1994. And so one of the things that's really interesting about that film is that Kubrick brought in all of these people who were experts in their industries, actual NASA engineers and computer experts and all of these people to design a lot of the technology in that film based on what they saw out there and where they thought things were going. And you had talked a little bit, I think, as well about the interface from the X-Men being a little bit inspired by, you know, some of the Mars exploration stuff. So it seems like there's kind of a feedback loop going on, you know, and I was wondering if you could comment on that a little bit.
Sure. There, truth be told, there should probably be one more bar at the very top, which is that direct influence from design work that ends up directly influencing the creators of science fiction. There's a great moment in the X-Men 2. I'm sorry if you haven't seen the movie because I can't really show it. Where Professor X sort of wheels his wheelchair into the prison where Magneto is being held. And you, is that the 10-minute mark? Thank you. Or are you just going, raise the roof? Sweet. And we see sort of a body scan going. And if you actually freeze frame that moment from the film, it directly comes from the Visible Human Project. So it was a piece of design that, wow, this would be sort of interesting way to, you know, make this beautiful interface that then became accessible to the science fiction makers. And they were like, holy cow, we can use that for this scene. So it happens all over the place. And yeah, we just haven't included that bar yet.
It's interesting to note that some of the most popular science fiction or some of the biggest movies and certainly some of the deepest favorite movies of, you know, designers, engineers, sci-fi fans, et cetera, are the ones that take the time to do this sort of more careful, sophisticated exploration of the future. They hire scientists like 2001. It was done again in Blade Runner, for instance, hired Sid Mead to be a visual futurist.
Minority Report,
of course. They spent weeks developing their backstory of the scenario of the technology, and that gestural language is actually a language that's fairly highly developed and very specific that they're true to in the film. They're not just sort of doing things. We have examples of, like in Star Wars, this is a great example in episode one, where Queen Amidala keeps hitting the same button in the movie and it's doing completely different things, right? So the sloppiness there of not worrying about the interface, some of the best sci-fi movies are very specific and careful about how they depict the interface and its sort of accuracy. And hiring designers and engineers is one of the ways that they do that. It's probably interesting to note that for the most part, back in 2001, I think, or 66, there probably weren't a lot of interface designers. So what they were relying on were engineers about explorations about technology. Now we have interface interaction designers, people who specialize in the interface portion in the same way that Star Trek hires linguists to actually build out Klingon or Romulan or other languages to have this sort of sense of authenticity and truth that they figure real aficionados are going to pick up on anyway. So we might as well be careful and do it right.
And one last bit, hopefully our criticism and not, I'm seeing the inclusive our, everyone here will sort of put pressure on them to get it more right. Cause it's embarrassing and takes you out of the film. And you're like, what that? No, there's no way. There's no way. So
I almost feel guilty doing this because it happens to me all the time when I go to science fiction conferences, not cons. And I present like in the same way that you're like, I'm only focusing on the films and TV. I do the same thing. And then all of my colleagues who've built entire scholastic careers on the literature pull the, you really need to check out. So I'm going to pull the
good.
I was going to say, like, the one thing that happens in the novels that can't happen in the film is the time and space to explain some of the interfaces. Yeah. So in Asimov and all his robot things, you actually get detailed descriptions of why they are human shaped and why that potentially works. But like I said, I almost feel guilty doing it, but it's definitely worth talking. Like I said, whenever I go traipsing to the conference with the people who've read all the literature,
it's a point well taken. And we have seen interfaces in books that we haven't seen in film yet. So it's kind of sad to ignore them for now, but we just have this huge list and we got to get through the list somehow. So maybe the second book we'll look at third book. Okay.
We have manga.
So if there's an incubation period, let's call it 30 years between something shows up in film and then it shows up, if you will, beginning an industry. What do you see now? In other words, if you were to look at the last 5 years, really cool sci-fi films that had ideas that I call near future, the next 100 years, give me a list of what I should go and look at. The films that you think are kind of cool.
You're looking to invest? I'm kidding. Actually, I answered this question at the DUX conference in Chicago, and I'll only give you one. I don't have a big list. But if we were to use this model to try and answer that question, what we would look for is an expectation that has been set by science fiction that is yet unmet by design. And hands down, the biggest one is the full body gestural interface that was embodied in Minority Report. People keep conflating like the iPhone and Jeff Hahn and Microsoft Surface as the gestural interfaces, but those are different things. Those are dipping your fingers in a magic pool to make something happen, as opposed to Minority Report, or even going back a little further to Sorcerer's Apprentice. As Mickey sort of raised his arms, magic was happening in the world around him, and that's the real promise of Minority Report, even if it threatens to exhaust us. So I would say that a full body gestural interaction is the technology that people are really craving out there in the world.
I'll add a couple, and that is, I'm not sure that it has to be full body, but it can be small hand like manipulation, like you would maybe manipulate clay. So it doesn't have to be, you know, you running around and jumping off walls and moving your arms, but it may be small manipulations that are essentially the same thing. 2D, 3D overlays with reality. I see that there's a lot of promise there because we're already talking about overlaying the virtual world into the physical so that that connection comes more direct and interactive. So I think we'll see lots of experiments there and hopefully a lot of successes because it seems like a natural way to work. And then the last example are from a purely visual standpoint. I think there's some really beautiful animated in meaning motion interfaces where the interfaces are always in motion. They're not just sort of static screens. So Star Trek is all about sort of static screens and buttons. And they have this underlying theory of user customizable interfaces. And that's really great, but things are fairly static. If you go look at the movie Lost in Space, which didn't do well in the box office or didn't get a lot of critical acclaim, the interfaces that are designed in them are beautifully rendered and they're always in motion. There's always something going on and it imparts not only a lot more data potentially, but it imparts this feeling that this is up to date and things are happening, and you have a view into that rather than everything's just sort of standing still. And so that's the other one I'll add. I'm sorry?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
If only teleporters.
So we have about 5 minutes, so maybe two quick questions.
This is actually not really a question. It's just bringing up to the point with the Minority Report visual deal, and that's maybe something to look for. It might be closer than we think. There's a really, really clever guy that's taken apart a Wii remote and has done several things with basically putting the LEDs on his fingers and interacting with the screen and doing stuff very similar to that. So
the point of that is that the technology actually isn't the driving problem here. The problem is, what do we use it for? And it's going to take a while for us to figure out like what these motion things are really going to be used for. Because again, if you're using Word or web browsing or Excel or Twitter, whatever, they're probably not not necessary. So it's good that this is being introduced now, because it's going to take us 10 or 20 years to really, hopefully not that long, figure out like what to do with it.
So we're big old geeks and would love to talk to you guys after this, but I think for time this is probably our last question.
I just wanted to ask about like the steampunk subgenre of science fiction, because you really have like retro science fiction. It's almost like looking in the back in the past of what we thought the vision of the future was, and what does that have any particular insights or tell us anything about what you're talking about interface design when we look back to what we thought the interface was going to be then, and that kind of thing?
Sure. I'll take two kind of half answers to that. The first, that we have been spared because there haven't been a lot of TV or movie made from it, except for that awful movie, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which frankly, I don't want to review.
Wild Wild West.
Giant spiders. Brazil. One's actually on our list. The second half answer to your question, I think, is that there will be some interesting things that come out of it, because essentially the promise of steampunk is that it's easier to understand the mechanical paradigms out of which they're building sort of computer-ish systems. We haven't gotten to it, so I don't have anything more detailed than that.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the steampunk, if you saw the first three clips that we presented, especially the first one where there was no interface because it was all just sort of real affordances on real devices, a lot of the steampunk is sort of ending, trying to go back there in some ways, not totally. There was another piece I was going to say. Oh, there's this moment in Star Trek Voyager where they build the Delta Flyer, and the pilot, they had designed a whole new spaceship. And he, aside from the normal kind of interfaces, he has this section that's, would look more like a airplane from 10 years ago, because it's got buttons and levers, etc., and it's all sort of retro. And I think that there's a tendency in steampunk to sort of do the retro thing, and it becomes kind of quaint. But if it's not thought out well, it never leaves quaint. It always sort of sits there in, oh yeah, retro, I get it, PT Cruiser, okay, next.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That craftedness that you're talking about in steampunk also lends itself really well in science fiction to sort of alien interfaces, because they look so, you have an opportunity to do things that are very different than what we feel today. And so it can play well there too.
Well, it's lunchtime. Thank you all very much.
Thanks a lot.